Welcome to Rural EdMed. I am Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner hospitalist, and today's topic is sepsis. There have been accounts of sepsis since man could write. Of course, our understanding and definition of sepsis have changed a bit over time. Ancient Egyptians provided the first written account of septic patients. Accounts began with infected wounds. Treatment centered on halting the putrefaction process using various plants and ointments. Patients were determined to be beyond saving when they developed modern systemic symptoms of fever, flushing, neck stiffness, convulsions, and a malodorous wound. Hippocrates is credited for coining the term sepsis. During his times, infection was attributed to an imbalance of humors. Infection was an excess of black bile, named for the darkening of blood that occurred in severe infection. It is known today that that darkening happens as a result of acute phase reactants in the blood and diminished oxygen saturation caused by decreased oxygen delivery, increased extraction, and mitochondrial dysfunction. We will discuss all of these things a little later in the lecture. Cyna was the first to use the term septicemia to describe blood putrefaction, which would later become known as bacteremia or bacteria in the blood. At this time, medical professionals were still unaware of the existence of bacteria, although philosophers had theorized the presence of some small particle in the body being responsible for disease. Ignaz was an obstetrician who observed that women in childbirth often died of sepsis due to puerperal fever. He made the connection that the med students who often performed their gynecologic exams were doing so after pathology courses in which they handled dead organic matter. He instituted hand washing, which was ill-received by his colleagues and superiors, despite bringing the mortality rate down from 18 to 2.5%. He was harassed and eventually fired, and that institution abandoned hand washing thereafter. He suffered a breakdown and was institutionalized at a mental facility. Ironically enough, he ended up dying of the very same disease, sepsis, that he was trying to eradicate, brought on from wounds suffered during the beatings he sustained while in the mental institution. Then there was good old Pasteur, the man credited with finally linking microbes with disease in the mid-1800s. The mid-1800s brought recognition of two distinct forms of shock, occurring from war and battle wounds as well. The first form of shock set on with large blood loss. A man became cool to the touch and delirious. This was known as hemorrhagic shock. If he survived, often a second type of shock set in a few days later, characterized by intense fever, circulatory collapse, and rapid death. This was septic shock. For many years, people believed that pus formation was necessary for wound healing and in fact took steps to cause wounds to fester. Kohnheim is credited with describing the actual makeup of pus, or white blood cells that migrate out through the walls of vessels of inflamed tissues. Although by the late 1800s, man did finally understand the nature of pus formation and that it was actually deleterious to wound healing, it wasn't until the 1900s that gloves came into routine use during surgery, thanks to a man by the name of Halsted. In 1830's epidemic of cholera, a GI disease characterized by severe diarrhea, brought much understanding about sepsis. A man named O'Shaughnessy made some rather crucial observations about the blood of septic patients, specifically about the lack of water in the blood of this population. O'Shaughnessy's observations led to the first IV infusion of saline. Using this information, Dr. Lotta would provide the first IV fluids to a woman in whom he had exhausted all options. The IV infusion apparently returned the glow to her skin and a palpable pulse to her wrist. Unfortunately, his belief that fluid resuscitation was key would not become the mainstay of sepsis treatment until the early 2000s, when a landmark sepsis study was published by Emmanuel Rivers. Dr. Rivers introduced the world to early goal-directed therapy. It changed everything that we know about sepsis treatment and directly led to a new standard of practice that turned the tide for a disease often synonymous with a death sentence. Patients presenting to the ED in severe sepsis or septic shock were randomized to receive 6 hours of either early goal-directed therapy, as outlined in Dr. Rivers' sepsis bundle, or standard therapy. They were then admitted to the intensive care unit, or ICU. The ICU care team was blinded to which treatment each of these patients had received during that initial 6 hours. In-hospital mortality rates dropped from 46.5% to 30.5% with the 6 hours of protocolized care. Patients who received early goal-directed therapy also had significantly higher mean central venous oxygen, or SCVO2, saturation, lower lactate concentration, and a higher pH. The differences were so huge that this protocol became a standard throughout the developed world and directly led to the formation of the Surviving Sepsis Collaborative and Surviving Sepsis Campaign. The bundle itself was found to be quite successful in sepsis care, although individual components had not been studied. The Surviving Sepsis Campaign recommendations were revised in 2012 after a convening of experts around the world. Lactic acid clearance was added as an endpoint for fluid resuscitation. It was suggested that some group of endpoints, such as urine output, blood pressure, and lactic acid clearance, could be substituted for SCVO2 monitoring. Antimicrobial recommendations included antibiotics within 1 hour, with a duration of 7 to 10 days or longer for certain cases. No antibiotics were recommended for SIRS, or systemic inflammatory response syndrome, without a known or suspected source. Antivirals were recommended for sepsis due to viral infections, and the use of procalcitonin was suggested to guide antibiotic therapy. Recommendations regarding oral decontamination to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia now included oral chlorhexidine specifically. Preferred IV fluids were listed as crystalloids or albumin. Starches fell out of favor and were shown to cause harm. On the topic of vasopressors, dopamine fell out of favor, both as a vasopressor and for use as a renal protective strategy. Experts suggested a trial of dobutamine and/or steroids for refractory shock. Finally, they made recommendations for stress ulcer and DVT prophylaxis, as well as glucose control. They changed the transfusion threshold to a hemoglobin less than 7 after several studies showed decreased morbidity and similar outcomes using a restrictive transfusion strategy. In 2014, another major sepsis trial came out. The PROCESS trial looked at comparisons between results achieved in sepsis care with an early goal-directed therapy, a less rigid protocol, and usual care. These three strategies resulted in nearly identical use of IV fluids and vasopressors, small differences in transfusion and dobutamine use, and large differences in central line and CVP monitoring use. Outcomes were similar with all methods. This may simply suggest that usual care in this age of surviving sepsis guidelines has become the same or similar to protocolized care, with the exception of CVP monitoring. CVP monitoring does not seem to change outcomes according to the study. The ARISE trial, a second randomized controlled trial with identical results, was just recently published and also evaluated septic patients receiving 6 hours of early goal-directed therapy using CVP and SCVO2 versus standard non-protocolized care. A third randomized controlled trial is expected to be published sometime in the near future on this same topic, the PROMISE trial. Before we can understand sepsis, we must understand some basic components of the immune response. Polymorphonucleocytes, or granulocytes, are named for their lobed nuclei and granules contained in the cytoplasm. Granulocytes are white blood cells that are attracted to the vascular epithelium, or lining, of the blood vessel. They attach and are essentially rolled down to the site of local inflammation, where they then lead the blood causing local vasodilation and hyperemia. They increase microvascular permeability, leading to edema. They also stimulate further activation of monocytes and macrophages. There are three types indicated by the acronym BEN, BEN. Basophils are involved in inflammation and fighting parasitic infections and viral disorders. They are also involved in fighting ectoparasitic infections such as ticks. Eosinophils play a huge role in allergy, asthma, and neoplasia. Allergy also includes rejection and autoimmune reactions. Neoplasia is the formation of tumors. Eosinophilia can be seen in parasitic infections, cancers, collagen vascular diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, and reflux disease as well. Neutrophils are increased with bacterial infections. They also increase with inflammation such as occurs after surgery, a heart attack, or a burn. Steroids and even stress can raise the count. While all of these cells help fight various infections, they also are all intimately related to inflammation. This is part of the reason that sepsis and SIRS appear so similar. Monocytes are white blood cells without granules in the cytoplasm. Monocytes are the cells in the blood that are later activated and migrate into the tissues to become macrophages. Some examples of macrophages are Kupffer cells in the liver and Langerhans cells in the skin and mucous membranes. Macrophages engulf and phagocytize, or eat, bacteria. They also attract granulocytes to the area, as well as stimulate the release of pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. The main pro-inflammatory cytokines are tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin-1. Their effects include fever, leukocytosis, activation of coagulation and fibrinolysis, and induction of other pro-inflammatory cytokines. Nitrous oxide is also a big inflammatory cytokine. As you might expect, one of its effects is massive venodilation within the area of infection or inflammation, resulting in increased delivery of blood with its various immune components. The septic or SIRS inflammatory response is somewhat different from what was just described. It consists of malignant intravascular inflammation. It is uncontrolled, unregulated, and self-sustaining. Blood spreads inflammatory mediators that are usually contained in the interstitial space. Sepsis and SIRS are an exaggeration of the normal inflammatory response. Imagine for a second that you cut your knee. Your body naturally increases blood flow to the area and makes the vessels leaky so that your immune cells can get to the cut and clean it out. Clotting is initiated so that bleeding will be limited. This localized reaction is maintained by anti-inflammatory mediators, or guards if you will, stationed along the perimeter of the injury. In sepsis, the pro-inflammatory mediators outnumber the anti-inflammatory ones. The inflammation breaks through and spreads unchecked. Intravascular volume drops from widespread leakage of fluids from the vessels. Vasopressin, a chemical that is released in response to low, water, or high solute concentration, secretion is depressed under circumstances that would normally stimulate it, and antidiuresis is halted. This is not simply a shock response, according to research studies. Vasopressin levels do not drop in patients with cardiogenic shock as they do in septic shock. Immune function is overactivated. Clots form in the microcirculation. Cells and organs begin to malfunction. Pro-inflammatory cytokines are more numerous, but also live longer because of delayed apoptosis or programmed cell death. Under normal circumstances, when blood pressure is low, the body automatically initiates vasodilation and constriction in such a way as to divert blood flow centrally to the major organs and away from non-essential areas such as the skin. In septic shock, there is often a failure of this mechanism. Sepsis is also often accompanied by myocardial depression. So now, not only is the vascular system dilated, the heart is less contractile, leaving the only way to increase cardiac output is tachycardia and fluid resuscitation using the Frank-Starling mechanism. If you remember back to school, more stretch equals more contractility up to a point, after which the heart is too stretched out to contract. Sepsis is also accompanied by decreased capillary density. This may be caused by tissue edema, which compresses capillaries to the point of obstructing flow. This is a problem because the capillaries are where actual oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange take place at the tissue level. Sepsis involves effects of widespread activation of inflammation on many of the other organs as well. In the lung, there is increased vascular permeability, which causes pulmonary edema and hypoxia. There is also a sepsis-related phenomenon that leads to severe, non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema known as acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. ARDS is unchecked inflammation of the lungs. Alveoli become flooded with immune cells, fluid, and debris. It is known as non-cardiogenic edema, as this fluid has very different makeup than usual pulmonary edema fluid. This fluid, along with free radicals produced by immune cells, actually damages the cells making up the lungs, leading to stiffness and fibrosis, possibly even permanent damage. This process also halts surfactant production. Surfactant is a chemical produced by lung cells that provides surface tension in order to prevent alveoli from collapsing completely with each breath. This allows gas exchange to occur with less energy and less friction of the alveoli. The result of surfactant loss is severe hypoxia, resistance to oxygen therapy, and damage and fibrosis of the actual lung tissues. In the GI tract, there is decreased blood flow to the gut with resulting dysfunction and possibly translocation of bacteria. Renal toxic mediators and/or decreased blood flow to the kidneys may cause renal dysfunction or failure. That's just to name a few. So why does normal inflammation become SIRS or sepsis? No one knows for sure, but there are many theories. There are endotoxins found in the cell walls of gram-negative bacteria, which are found to be elevated in the plasma of septic patients. Endotoxins directly activate parts of the immune system, such as the complement, coagulation, and fibrinolysis. Inflammatory cytokine tumor necrosis factor alpha levels also are higher in septic patients, and symptoms of sepsis can be replicated with an infusion of this cytokine, as shown with animal models. Various single nucleotide polymorphisms have been associated with susceptibility to infection and poor infection outcomes. This suggests an inherited susceptibility to sepsis. The cellular injury and tissue damage that occurs in sepsis is thought to have a multifactorial cause. Tissue ischemia results from inadequate oxygen delivery to some tissues, while others receive supernormal delivery. Inflammation activates the clotting cascade, and tiny clots can block oxygen delivery. Inflammatory chemicals directly damage vascular endothelium, leading to thrombosis. Erythrocytes also lose their ability to deform, reducing the microcirculatory flow. Then there is cytopathic cell injury. Products of inflammation, such as tumor necrosis factor alpha, endotoxins produced by gram-negative bacteria, and nitrous oxide damage mitochondrial proteins. If you remember back to ANP, the mitochondria is where ATP is made, either in the presence of oxygen with high ATP output or anaerobically with a much smaller output and lactate as a byproduct. We used to believe that damage of sepsis resulted from having low oxygen levels. Some of you might remember putting supplemental oxygen on all septic patients. Studies of septic animals actually shows normal or supernormal oxygen tension in organs, however. How the damage to mitochondria is specifically induced is unknown, but ATP production declines and lactate production increases, suggesting some dysfunction in how the mitochondria are able to use oxygen. The result is impaired mitochondrial electron transport, inability to utilize oxygen even when present, and cell death. Studies of human survivors versus non-survivors of sepsis support all of this. They show that the skeletal muscle concentration of ATP is much lower in non-survivors and the lactate concentration much higher. And this cannot be fixed by simply increasing oxygen delivery. The glycocalyx is an endothelial layer made up of glycoproteins and proteoglycans and is the key determinant of membrane permeability of the vasculature. Although inflammatory cytokines increase permeability to fluids, it is fluid resuscitation that actually denudes the glycocalyx and makes the vascular wall permeable to plasma proteins, leading to severe interstitial edema. I'm sure you have heard of patients with low albumin, a protein, being more at risk for edema. Protein in the blood is what provides the gradient to keep fluid or plasma in the intravascular space. When protein is in the interstitial space, then fluid follows. So here's a case study. Does this woman have SIRS, sepsis, or severe sepsis? Anna B. is a 63-year-old, 72-kilogram female admitted with right rib fractures 2 through 8 and a small pulmonary contusion sustained during a fall off of her horse. Admission vitals include blood pressure 156 over 67, heart rate 76, respiratory rate 18, oxygen saturation 92% on room air. Her labs are only significant for an elevated white blood cell count of 17,000. Overnight, she struggles with deep breathing and mobilization due to pain and requires increasing amounts of narcotics. This morning, her vitals are blood pressure 160 over 68, heart rate 118, respiratory rate 28, temperature 100.2, oxygen saturation 90% on 7 liters nasal cannula. White blood cells are still elevated at 16,000 on labs. Creatinine remains normal and lactic acid is 0.5. A repeat chest x-ray shows only mild atelectasis bilaterally. Urine is dark and concentrated despite continuous IV hydration. Urine output averages about 40 milliliters per hour. So let's go over some definitions. SIRS criteria include two or more of the following without evidence of cerebral vascular accident or acute myocardial infarction. Temperature greater than 100.4 or less than 96.8. Heart rate greater than 90. Respiratory rate greater than 20 or partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the blood less than 32. White blood cells greater than 12,000, less than 4,000, or greater than 10% bands. Systolic blood pressure less than 90, or mean arterial pressure less than 65. Sepsis is just SIRS with clinical suspicion of infection. Now let's look at whether Anna has met any of these criteria. Her temperature was 100.2, her respiratory rate 28, her blood pressure was 160 over 68. Her heart rate was 118. Her white blood cells were 16,000. Interestingly enough, two of the most common causes of non-infectious SIRS are pulmonary contusion and pancreatitis. Severe sepsis is sepsis without any evidence of end organ damage, such as hypotension before fluid resuscitation, elevated lactic acid, urine output less than 0.5 milliliters per kilogram per hour despite adequate fluid resuscitation, creatinine greater than 2, bilirubin greater than 2, platelets less than 100,000, INR greater than 1.5 and not due to Coumadin use, PF ratio less than 250 if the patient does not have pneumonia or less than 200 with pneumonia. Septic shock is sepsis-related hypotension despite adequate fluid resuscitation. A review of Anna's blood pressure, lactic acid, urine output, and creatinine reveals that she does not meet criteria for severe SIRS. Your initial laboratory assessment for suspected SIRS or sepsis should include the following. Complete blood count, or CBC, with differential. We are looking at white blood cells. The differential includes white blood cell types such as neutrophils, basophils, and lymphocytes. This will tell us something about whether we are looking at something bacterial, viral, parasitic, autoimmune. Unexpected anemia could explain tachycardia and hypotension. Increased immature white blood cells, or BANs, tells us something about an infection that has overwhelmed the system in a patient who may have a normal white blood cell count. Basic metabolic panel, or complete metabolic panel. With this, we are looking at renal function, electrolytes, and with a complete panel, we add liver function. This tells us about end organ damage. How bad is the infection? Electrolytes are going to be essential to normalizing sepsis because of their effects on the cardiovascular system, which is already debilitated. Lactic acid is normally produced by the body and eliminated by the kidneys. In sepsis, greater quantities are produced and/or the body has more difficulty removing this, leading to it being elevated. Greater than 2 is concerning. Greater than 4 usually indicates severe sepsis. Blood cultures, urine, sputum, wound exudate cultures, chest and abdominal films, chest, abdominal, or head CT, and LP are tests you would do if you suspected bacteremia, urinary tract infection, pneumonia, cellulitis, or meningitis. Bacteremia is common in sepsis and is associated with poor outcomes. Therefore, every septic patient needs blood cultures. Just a fun little fact, research has shown that most patients presenting with Rigers end up having bacteremia. Back to Anna again. If you remember, her respiratory rate was 28 and her oxygen saturations were 90% on 7 liters nasal cannula. She did not have information to calculate a PF ratio for determining severity because she did not have ABGs. Should she have them now? Criteria for obtaining ABGs include respiratory rate greater than 20 and or an oxygen saturation less than 90% on room air or below baseline for that patient. She presented needing only 2 liters nasal cannula, so she meets both criteria. We now move into monitoring of the septic patient. We will use telemetry so that we can know what the heart is doing. There are a number of things affecting the heart during sepsis. First, there is a release of myocardial depressant factors. Second, inflammatory cytokines can irritate the heart directly and puts the patient at risk for electrolyte imbalances, which also affects the heart. This places septic patient at risk for deadly arrhythmias. Third, a percentage of patients with sepsis will suffer an acute coronary event. Accurate urine output is critical, especially in the rural setting. We very rarely use central lines and do not have the capabilities to measure SCVO2. This makes it essential that we have as many of the other choices available for titrating fluid resuscitation as possible. Lactic acid clearance is coming forward as perhaps a more accurate way to gauge fluid resuscitation efforts, even when compared to SCVO2 monitoring. To make this calculation, lactic acid must be measured 2 to 6 hours after fluid resuscitation has begun. Finally, if a patient is hypotensive after receiving at least 30 milliliters per kilogram, or approximately 2 liters in an average-sized adult, of crystalloid fluids, you should treat as severe sepsis and septic shock. In the initial treatment of sepsis, severe sepsis, or septic shock, all patients get early source control, including an antibiotic based on the suspected source, within 1 hour. All will have an initial fluid bolus. Accuchecks with a goal glucose of 140 to 180 is critical as both hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia result in impaired healing and immune function. DVT and stress ulcer prophylaxis is indicated in all septic patients unless they are in DIC or disseminated intravascular coagulation or actively bleeding. Fever must be treated aggressively as it increases oxygen requirements for a body that is already overly strained. In severe sepsis and septic shock, a second antimicrobial agent will be added for 3 to 5 days. Recommendations for that second agent include gentamicin, tobramycin, levofloxacin, ciprofloxacin, or vancomycin. As Dr. Rivers so eloquently showed, the first 6 hours of sepsis is critical. Fluids are still one of the mainstays of sepsis treatment, but now we know that too much fluid can be quite bad. That is why we need to be titrating to some endpoint. As you well know, there are difficulties with all of our endpoints available in rural care. Mean arterial pressure may not be helpful once vasopressors are started. Urine output is difficult to use in the setting of kidney disease or dysfunction. CVP is affected by heart functions, arrhythmias, pulmonary function, and has been shown to be an inaccurate measure of fluid responsiveness in the critically ill. The term fluid responsiveness refers to whether fluids will help clinically versus whether a particular endpoint is achieved. Lactic acid clearance only gives general information over a period of several hours. SCVO2 requires invasive lines that themselves put patients at risk. Bedside ultrasound vena cava distensibility index has recently been in the limelight as a measure to predict fluid responsiveness. It has been shown to be at least as accurate as any of the other measures in use today, and it can be done with the bedside ultrasound machines that we use for starting lines and IVs with the correct probe attached. Unfortunately, it does require a lot of training to use. If you determine that more fluids will cause harm, it is important to keep in mind that you may substitute 5% albumin for crystalloid at a 1 to 1.4 milliliter ratio for patients unable to tolerate large volume loads. You should consider initiating vasopressors if there is persistent shock present after the initial 2-liter bolus. You should also assess ejection fraction with an echo and add inotropic agents as needed. Now, just a little bit about vasopressors. Norepinephrine is first line. This can be dosed in micrograms per minute or micrograms per kilogram per minute. Short-term infusions through a peripheral IV is acceptable. You may want to keep pentolamine handy at the bedside in case of infiltration, although actual tissue damage from infiltration has been shown to be exceedingly rare in patients who are monitored for infiltration and caught relatively early. Vasopressin may be added at a steady dose of 0.03 units per minute as a second agent if the patient is requiring greater than 10 micrograms per minute of norepinephrine. There is no titration of this drug. Epinephrine is recommended as an additional second-line agent if you are unable to achieve hemodynamic goals on norepinephrine. It is also dosed in micrograms per minute or micrograms per kilogram per minute. Do not infuse this through a peripheral IV if it can be avoided. After the first 6 hours, a positive fluid balance becomes associated with an increase in mortality, reaching a peak association at 72 hours. Unfortunately, even with adequate initial fluid resuscitation, a septic patient may remain hypotensive. Some of the negative effects of fluids at this point include pulmonary edema, increased production and release of nitric oxide, and brain natriuretic peptide, or BNP, release, which result in vasodilation, disruption of the cell wall glycocalyx with fluid shifts from the intravascular to interstitial space, and myocardial depression. The question then becomes, will more fluid help or hurt? You will need to consider causes of hypotension that are unresponsive to fluid resuscitation. Septic cardiomyopathy is when the left ventricular ejection fraction is less than 50% in the absence of cardiac disease and is reversible on recovery from sepsis. Diastolic dysfunction is also common. This is treated with inotropes such as dobutamine. Dobutamine does have vasodilating properties but can actually raise blood pressure in septic cardiomyopathy if the cause of hypotension is decreased contractility. It can also be combined with vasopressors. Repletion of electrolytes is essential in septic cardiomyopathy to enhance cardiac function. Adrenal insufficiency occurs with depletion of adrenal hormones secondary to critical illness or chronic steroid use prior to illness. If the mean arterial pressure is less than 65 after fluids and norepinephrine infusion, start corticosteroid treatment. Hydrocortisone 50 mg IV every 6 hours is often used, especially in patients with chronic steroid use. No adrenocorticotropic hormone stimulation test is necessary. Symptomatic anemia can occur due to blood loss, bone marrow suppression from an out-of-control infection, or decreased hemopoiesis. You should transfuse for a hemoglobin less than 7. In conclusion, you need to understand that sepsis and SIRS is an exaggeration of the normal inflammatory response. Endotoxins from bacteria and pro-inflammatory cytokines are present in exaggerated quantities and directly lead to myocardial depression, vasodilation, and leaky blood vessels. Blood pressure may drop. Tachycardia, tachypnea, and fever are common symptoms. The treatment is quite simple. Fill the tank, but don't overfill it. Kill the source. If it can't be killed, then support healing so that the SIRS response will no longer be needed. You don't have time to wait on diagnosing the source. That patient doesn't have any business even hitting the main floor for admission unless someone has an idea about that source and has taken initial steps towards resolving it. That means the ED needs to be able to recognize these syndromes. Finally, know that sepsis and SIRS can affect every major organ. You absolutely must monitor renal function, blood pressure, mental status, cardiac function, everything. You may not need an ICU, but you do need staff that recognize that this is a full-body disorder.